This is a reading of a collection of essays and lectures by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Education of the Child and Early Lectures on Education. This is the fourth lecture in the series, entitled Interests, Talents, and Educating Children, given in Nuremberg, November 14, 1910. When outsiders consider the attitude and way of thinking of spiritual science, and judge its content using the prevalent way of thinking that could easily conclude, somewhat correctly from their standpoint, that spiritual science creates high ideals out of thin air. Those ideals tend toward what outsiders might call self-styled knowledge of nature and the human soul and spirit. They might then say that those ideas and understandings are quite beautiful and satisfy the inner longings of the soul, and that it is understandable that those unconvinced by conventional science would be led to believe spiritual science the thirst of their souls. If someone familiar with spiritual science says something about the sense-perceptible world or things in the conventional scientific domain, then an outsider might say it all sounds fantastic. That fantastic aspect is quite evident to an outsider. Those within spiritual science can easily understand how someone could find so much fantasy there. People with a conventional scientific perspective might easily say they cannot do anything with spiritual science. We can easily understand that. In contrast, let us now consider someone who has penetrated spiritual science more deeply, who has gained insight into what the soul presents and has learned what the human soul and the human spirit actually are. Such a person will have quite different feelings. Such a person could look at the conventional view of the world and see what has arisen as its tasks, goals, and values, and how it has affected practical life. What materialism says about various areas of cultural activity seems quite fantastic to someone within spiritual science. For example, we need only hear what it has to say about education. To the spiritual researcher, it simply sounds like a lot of slogans and clichés. We can look at the wide range of pedagogical effort and everywhere find sugar-coated words. Who has not heard, for example, quote, we should avoid stuffing things into children's souls, or, quote, we should develop human individuality, unquote. But who can say anything beyond such extravagant slogans if what human individuality is has not been properly comprehended? In contrast to spiritual science, materialistic science is simply a sum of abstractions and as such is unrealistic. Someone who comprehends spiritual science must therefore reply that spiritual science not only wants to be practical, but also attempts to see the real foundation of things that is possible particularly in the area of education. If we use spiritual science to think imaginatively about a child, then as we face the growing child living into life, we are overcome by the feeling that before us stands a sacred riddle. If we work with the child, we must seek to solve that riddle with a deep sense of reverence. We feel in that growing soul something different from everything we see. We feel that something unknown lives in the developing human being, and that feeling is correct. Our modesty and reverence cannot be great enough when we face the task of educating the child. Our humility before that being who presents us with a new riddle to solve can also not be great enough. I would not dare to speak about it if I had worked only with spiritual science. I do, however, dare to speak about it because, as a teacher, I have felt that sacred riddle for some 15 years. From the modern standpoint, it is child's play not only to deride such things, but also with an apparent right to refute as fantastic the idea of human reincarnation and the reappearance of people in new lives. Today we will only mention in passing the idea of reincarnation, that our embodied souls living today through the period between birth and death have often gone through life. We will only mention that we live today so that later we can experience the effects and fruits of this life. People can easily refute that in theory. However, things look different when you teach with the correct feelings and see how the growing soul of the child develops from week to week and from year to year. If you approach your desire to teach with the proper attitude, then you will recognize that you will be affecting something developed over millennia. If you consider everything children do and everything you do from that perspective, then you can see how fruitful education can be. Those who know the laws of logical proof know the impossibility of proving this point of view through formal logic. However, if you work with this in mind, then you will feel the truth. We certainly confront a difficult task when we want to understand how the child's soul develops. Everyone knows the purely external facts. However, who has not experienced how powerless teachers often are when the law or parents' demands define their tasks? Who has not experienced the frustration when the assigned tasks contradict the child's innate interests and talents? Who has not felt and seen the truth that even the greatest efforts achieve nothing if we do not take the child's aptitudes into account? How often life has shown us that we are powerless not only before the child's lack of ability, but also before our own lack of understanding. We attempt to educate, but if we educate improperly, the effects are not immediately visible. However, if we follow a student's life, we often see something quite curious, namely that talents and predispositions later arise from the child's soul only after difficult struggles. Then we can see that had we only recognized them and been more helpful, we could have spared the child much that occurred later. We see how necessary it is to focus upon the difficult question of the child's innate interests and gifts, and that we must take them into account in our teaching. People are very unclear about such basic questions today, because modern ideas and concepts inevitably numb people. One such concept is that of heredity, but such concepts form people's entire attitude. When speaking of a child's aptitudes, who would not first think of asking how much the child inherited from his or her parents and ancestors? Goethe once spoke of that with understandable modesty, but in a way based upon a deep awareness. Quote, "From father I have stature, for the seriousness of life, from mother a happy nature and a love for storytelling." Unquote. After relating a few other things about heredity, he closes with, quote, "What now lives in the little imp that can still be called original," end quote. Footnote, Wolfgang Johannes Goethe, Zahme Sinnein, Gentle Satires, Volume 6, Number 32, end of footnote. Posterity has already given a partial answer, and will continue to answer in future generations. Someone who has spent some 20 years studying Goethe certainly has a right to say something. With all due respect to the Frankfurt councilman from whom Goethe inherited his stature for the seriousness of life, if you look at how Goethe led his life, you will certainly have respect for what he inherited from his father. If you look at the agile and caring way his mother looked at life and interacted with people, then you will certainly see what Goethe wants to say he inherited from his mother. What is the result if you put these together? If you put them together and think about it, you will find that what he could not have inherited is his effectiveness. What could not be inherited is Goethe himself, and what the guiding forces allowed to stream into him and used to express themselves. It is the same with everyone as it is with great people. You cannot move forward if you try to attribute everything to heredity without considering the individual who develops according to its own laws. Thus, if you consider life objectively, the question becomes less simple. That is, what is the relationship between what we can trace back to our ancestors and what is obviously there, what is personal? Spiritual science certainly does not deny inherited characteristics, but how does it view heredity? You can, of course, see heredity everywhere. There are people who claim that when characteristics appear that cannot be found in the ancestors, we can still point to heredity, because those abilities may have been present previously, though undeveloped. This is often said and often disputed. People who speak this way have only a vague concept of innate capacities, which is not realistic because they invent explanations for everything. It seems to me that someone who does that is the same as one who says that every brick has a tendency to fall on people's heads. It just needs someone to be there. One who thinks realistically certainly cannot speak of innate capacities in that way. The task of a genuine pedagogy is to separate the hereditary from the non-hereditary. By using an example from the animal kingdom, we can create a picture of heredity. A chicken egg contains the whole seed of the chicken, but it needs heat from outside. Therefore, we can see that heat is a basic element that does not exist in the seed itself. Nevertheless, superficial observation will show that animals can inherit certain things, whereas we, when we speak of human beings, we must certainly admit that there are some things we cannot inherit. Think of what we call instinct. It is unquestionably in the animal from the very beginning, so we must consider it to be inherited. Because an animal is part of a whole species and inherits all of the characteristics of that species, its manual skill, for example, is much greater than that of human beings. Human beings are much worse off than animals in that way. People who speak with humility customarily create humble concepts. Those who speak with pride create proud concepts. They tend to say that animals are lower than human beings. This is not true in an absolute sense. For instance, anyone can read about how long it took human intelligence to develop paper, but wasps developed it long before that. If we study the animal kingdom, then we can see how ostensibly intellectual activities develop from simple instincts. However, we may not then conclude that human beings are less intelligent than animals. People cannot inherit certain things. Everyone would agree that a wasp inherits the skill to construct its nest. However, there can be no doubt that a human being set in the wilderness would never develop language or self-awareness. Human beings cannot inherit speech and self-awareness. Heredity does not contain them. People must always learn them anew. Thus, even superficial observation shows that we cannot address the most important things for humanity in the same way as we do those of the animal kingdom. On the other hand, who could deny the existence of things that we can inherit? Who would deny Schopenhauer's statement that he inherited much of his thoughtful character from his mother and much of the nature of his will from his father? Who would deny that there is something important and truthful in that, even if awkwardly expressed? We can see that human beings do, in fact, enter earthly existence with inherited characteristics, and it is our task to differentiate those inherited traits from those not inherited. This is what experience shows us. Nevertheless, someone could agree that we do not inherit speech and self-awareness, but that we still do not need to make such subtle distinctions because everything will work out. When a human being is born into a particular linguistic region, he or she will learn to speak. Are there other non-hereditary characteristics whose source we must seek at a deeper level in the human personality? It is not so easy to differentiate those non-hereditary traits and talents within human nature from hereditary ones. Clearly, it is heredity when 7 musicians are born to the Bach family. Nevertheless, those who approach education realistically can do nothing other than separate the essence of the individual from what is inherited. We must be very clear about the role of heredity. We see that when a child enters earthly existence, he or she is more like the father in some ways, and more like the mother in others. We see the child has certain characteristics from the mother and others from the father. Someone who considers life objectively will soon notice that there is in fact a difference between what the father gives to the child and what the mother gives. Of course, these things intermingle, but we can differentiate between the elements coming from the mother and those coming from the father. If you look more closely, the distribution of these 2 factors becomes clear. We can see that all the inherited characteristics related to the quality of intelligence and the capacity for reason can in some way be traced back to some characteristics of the mother. The traits we can summarize as steadfastness of character, strength, and an ability to enter into life which have a will-like quality, whether in the son or in the daughter, can be traced back to characteristics of the father. Notice I did not say that we can trace the child's intelligence back to the intelligence of the mother, but that we can trace it back to the nature of the mother's intelligence, and that we can trace the child's steadfastness back to the nature of the father's character. If you look at these things in more detail, you will soon see significant differences between the course of the parents' lives and the nature of the child's life, particularly regarding whether a child is born early or late in the marriage. An educator can see quite different relationships of the child to the parents depending upon whether the child is born early or late in the marriage. Observation shows that in children born later in the marriage, when the parents have already had experience in their work, the mother's or father's characteristics are much more strongly represented, and the children bear the imprint of the parents much more clearly. In that case, there is greater intellectual flexibility and a more firmly contoured character. It is interesting to consider children in this manner when we attempt to answer the question of what heredity carries. Heredity is an expression of prior processes in the physical world. What is hereditary? Hereditary characteristics are genuinely part of the physical body. If we say characteristics of intelligence are hereditary, then we must say these are connected with the physical body, that is, the brain. Since we are given that instrument, it is natural that we show hereditary characteristics. We inherit the finer details of our organs, and we must accept them. In this way, we can explain our dependencies on those organs, since we inherit them. To make a gross comparison, if you are born with one hand, you will see how much you depend on it. Essentially, it is always the physical body that comes into consideration when we speak of heredity, as I have done here. What practical observations of life reveal as the core of our being crystallizes from that. And we are unable to understand it if we trace it back to heredity. A child is born with a certain intellectual flexibility, with a capacity to reason. We can look at the mother and see that it originates with her. We study the child's character and then look at the father and can gain some insight about it. However, something special remains that is the most important thing for the educator, since only when we can bring it into harmony with inherited traits can education be successful. We can trace the way reason develops back to the mother, but the quality of reasoning indicates particular realms of life, and we cannot trace that back to the mother. The characteristics of one mother will show us a tendency toward music, those of another toward mathematics. It would be a great error to direct intelligence everywhere. The quality of intelligence is hereditary, but we cannot inherit the particular direction, the talent for this or that, although it is contained within the kind of intelligence. Thus, as teachers, our task is to look at the mother and comprehend the flexibility of intelligence, for instance, why a child thinks slowly or quickly. But we must also recognize the child's specifically individual tendency toward this or that. We can clearly see the characteristics inherited from the father in a different way. We can understand the child's steadfastness of character and certainty of will when we look at the father. However, one thing we cannot so easily understand is the direction of interest that crystallizes out of the core of the child's being. We see in one child one direction of interest, and in another child another. These are specific to the individual. To proceed wisely as educators, we must ask how the mother's way of reasoning and the father's character traits present themselves. If we are to properly educate, we must recognize interests lying within the child's character and the direction of intelligence. We can easily confuse these. That is why the father has so much difficulty raising a child who is particularly like him. And the other way around, when a child is particularly like the mother has great difficulty with the child. Children who are particularly like their father are more easily raised by the mother, and children who are particularly like their mother are more easily raised by the father. If a child is like the father, then he or she has the will impulses of the father. However, the father cannot transfer his interests to the child. The child's talents arise within the realm of the mother, with the result that in this area the father can understand very little of the child. The child will hone itself on the father's character, but the mother can best care for the child's talents. In the reverse case, when the child is more like the mother, it will be difficult for the mother to follow the child's interest in the way the father can. The golden rule is, talents form in all quietude, character in the rush of the world. Talents develop in the loving care of the mother, character in the firm care of the father. Usually we do not meet people who clearly present the mixture of characteristics inherited from the mother and the father. Generally, either the father's or the mother's influence predominates. A very important rule for teaching follows from that. Suppose the motherly element predominates. Then we can often see how much the child seems like the mother, and can easily guess his or her specific talent. However, when the fatherly element has been pushed aside, we will have considerably more difficulty finding the particular interests that lie within what the child has inherited from the father. In that case, as teachers, we must look at what heredity has not accomplished. We must look particularly closely at the father to see whether he is easygoing or rigid. Then we must develop the repressed inherited characteristics. We can do that if we direct our attention toward the other side. We will soon discover the child's talents and capabilities. But what heredity does not provide, we must achieve through education. What should the educator do? Here we have something of tremendous importance. When the teacher sees that something the child could have inherited from the father is not clearly apparent, then he or she must work to direct the child's talents. The child's attention must be directed toward tasks and activities consistent with the child's talents. The talents must be captivated by external objects. Children who are more like the mother must become accustomed to being surrounded by objects consistent with their talents, toward which their attention can be directed. It is not appropriate to follow the rule that because children have interests, they should be allowed to simply follow them. Suppose a child is particularly like the father. Then we will have difficulty guessing what his or her talents and capacities are. But the child's interests will be clearly expressed through the will. The interests will live in the strength of the child's desires. We must be particularly careful not to base our conclusions about the child's real talents upon his or her interests. In this case, we must carefully study the child's interests in the proper manner. If we allow interests to mature for which no talent exists, we harm the child. An interest of the soul for which there is no corresponding talent will turn upon the soul. This constantly causes illness and disturbs the physical nervous system. Many such cases can be traced back to people's lack of understanding about how to harmonize interests with talent. We can learn much by seeing how children's impulsive expressions of particular interests lead to awkwardness, and on the other hand, how other interests lead to gracefulness. We give this little attention, but we should carefully classify interests. Furthermore, as a teacher, you have the task of restraining interests that would lead to awkwardness. You can best accomplish that if you ask how the father and the mother are. You must then discover the essence of the child's nature that crystallized out of the heritage of the mother and the father. We can truly say, therefore, that education must be based on knowledge, not on slogans like, quote, education in harmony, unquote, or, quote, consider the individual, unquote. Just try to educate harmoniously when you don't know where interests lead, or try to emphasize the individual when you don't know how to find what is specific to the individual. This is only one aspect of education, however. Human beings come into the world not just for their own sake, but also for the sake of humanity. We cannot simply accept what appears in the child. The teacher will soon notice a complementary relationship that we in spiritual science call the laws of karma. You can easily see that beings are placed where they have something to do in the world. Edelweiss does not grow in the plains, but upon the mountain tops. Everything grows within its own element, and cannot thrive where it does not belong. It is the same with the essence of the human being, which places itself in that element where it belongs. Things are more harmonious than we might think. For this reason, talents are more in harmony with those of the mother, and interests more with those of the father. Nevertheless, we must also look in the other direction. Human beings depend upon the fact that individuals do not speak their own private languages, but the language of the area where they are born. That is, they are dependent upon the people in their surroundings. Thus, an entire manner of thinking and feeling enters deeply into the soul through language. That is coarsely observable. Compare the soul of someone from Franconia with that of someone from West Prussia. Footnote, translator's note, this would be comparable in contemporary United States to comparing someone raised in Louisiana with someone from New York. End footnote. And then try to see how language affects the entire manner of thinking and perceiving. It is that way with everything. Namely, people are placed into life according to their qualities. Thus, if we want to educate consciously, we must know that we do not educate people only as individuals. Just as we cannot provide each child with an individual language, so we also cannot do something special for each child. Human nature is organized so that people adapt to the existing cultural process. We must raise children in what belongs to humanity, and it must take root in them. When this becomes apparent to us, we must acknowledge powerlessness against those elements. If we look at the child's talents and then at the demands of life, it might appear impossible for us to bring them into harmony. Let us look at two children. One child is born in an environment and learns a particular language. He or she grows up with that language, and it becomes a part of his or her soul, a part of the innermost human being. Anyone who has thought about the relationship of language to human nature will know that through language, people learn not only how to reason logically, but also how to reason through feeling. For example, the way the ah or oo sound works in a language tremendously affects the soul's capacity to feel. Language provides a skeleton for feelings and perceptions. Imagine another child who, due to life's events, had to learn another language immediately after barely learning his or her mother tongue, mother language. Compare this child with one who is totally integrated with his or her language, so that not only is thinking done in that language, but also the child has learned to be in it. Then you will see that the soul life of this second child is much less settled, much less solid. A language that forms a skeleton for the soul results in a sounder nature. A language that carries the soul makes the soul less stable and less certain. Thus, the soul of a child who develops in the latter way is much more easily irritated and does not meet life's external influences as vigorously. Language can teach us the great importance of connecting educational principles and what later becomes the content of life with what occurs earlier. Everything inconsistent in education significantly destroys the life of the soul. When we fail to build upon what occurred earlier, we inflict the greatest damage upon the soul. In contrast, a conscious connection has a marvelous effect. If you often sit with a child with a weak character and begin, so that the child does not notice, to speak about things that happened 3 years before, you can more easily reprimand the child than when you refer to events of the present. You can strengthen the child's character by using memories of earlier occurrences. We commit major errors if we attempt to correct the child through punishment or controls that arise out of our present anger. We can easily make mistakes when the deed is fresh. Life is not without contradiction, and people must make errors. However, we can correct them. If you need to correct, then sit with the child and speak about an earlier misbehavior, since the child is past it and no longer feels what occurred earlier. Feelings become numb and go a very different way than thoughts and memory. We see that we can objectively discuss things that occurred earlier, and the more often we do that and refresh the child's memory of what happened, the more we can develop character. These are simply rules that result from objective observations. Of course, you need a spiritual, scientific view to gather the individual events together, but then you can understand them and draw important conclusions. We must look not only at the individual, but at the whole. Then we must look toward creating harmony between individual nature and human nature. If you return to past events, it is possible to bring out a certain kind of sympathy. You will, for example, find it difficult to bring selfishness into harmony with the demands of the surroundings. However, if you go back to past experiences, then you will notice that you can engage the child. The educator must bring earlier experiences into harmony with what occurs later. Teachers must be careful to bring individual children into harmony with the demands of all humankind by working with past occurrences. The more you reach back into the child's previous experiences, the better you can teach. This is how you should look for what is good for educating children. We are amiss in allowing obvious talent to go undeveloped, and by placing children in continuous contradiction to their surroundings, this causes illness. Suppressed talents and interests slip into people's inner being, and later can result in illnesses of the soul. We sin against human health if we allow children's interests to go undeveloped. We are also amiss to neglect the adjustment of children to their surroundings. If we fail to do this, a contradiction between the child's soul and life's demands will cause a deep dissatisfaction with life. One who understands the human soul could say that all the interests that should have been nurtured and all the talents that should have been developed are missing in those who wander through life, saying how difficult life is. This results in people who cannot find their way in life and become dissatisfied as a result. Now, you could easily say that everything I have said relates to inner soul characteristics found within the intellect and the will. However, those are the most important things for the educator, since they show the essence of the soul, and this is where teachers can create the most misfortune. How is that? The development of interests and talents results in a kind of fluidity of reasoning at an early stage, but at 30 years of age it becomes a dexterity in the fingers and hands. Awkwardness at the age of 30 can be traced back to the fact that flexible thinking was not learned around age 7. The lack of participation that occurs if we do not develop interests reveals itself as indifference in all manner of practical responsibilities. We must recognize that the core of human nature expresses itself in those character traits. A spiritual scientist would recommend that a child play. Why do children play, and why should they play? Here I want to say something about later life. You all certainly are aware of something that occurs in life, namely being tired. However, where does fatigue arise? You often hear the reply that fatigue occurs in the evening when the muscles are worn out. Is it true that the muscles, due to their nature, come into a state of fatigue? If that were so, then you would certainly ask how tired the muscles in our heart would be. They would certainly need to rest. It is not in the nature of muscles to become tired. Muscles do what they need to do. They do not become tired. External activity does not affect the muscles of the heart. Fatigue arises only when you make your muscles do something related to the external world, something connected with conscious activity. Disharmony between the demands of the outer world and our muscles causes fatigue. The truth is that fatigue arises only because of a disharmony between our inner constitution and the outer world. Fatigue shows that a certain contradiction exists between the outer world and inner life. You must be aware that the human cultural process proceeds not only according to laws implanted in the individual in constitution. The nature of the human soul is directed not only toward the preservation of the species, but also toward the development of soul and spirit. Here, two streams are expressed, progress and organic structure. In the eternal laws of existence, it is written that human beings must sacrifice purely natural laws to spiritual laws. Those who understand these things will not complain, but will comprehend entirely that a counterbalance is necessary. We must have a healthy preparation for life, so that we can act on external things with our hands and think about external things with our brains. We must create a balance that is possible only when we are in a position to do things at a particular time that the outer world does not require, and to be satisfied with the activity itself. Human nature meets that need through playing. It is best for the child if we allow play to be individually oriented, since that creates inner strength. If we structure play, then you will certainly see what results. Today people want to standardize everything. Modern people cannot even admit that we need clothing cut to the individual. A basic tendency of modern culture is that we should feed even the most extreme followers of Nietzsche from the same pot. Footnote, translator's note, Nietzsche's core value was that of extreme individualism. End quote. We should not introduce standardization into the upbringing of children, especially not in play. We must allow play to be individualistic. We must give special attention to what the talents and interests of each child are, for otherwise we would sin. That brings us, as practicing teachers, to the need to believe that it is the child's spirit and not the muscles that must have the strength to resist wear and tear. Spirit and soul must be independent in play, so that material things have no effect. Thus, in play, children can remain unaffected by the tiring influences of the outer world. If we do not believe in an inwardly free soul, we cannot teach effectively. If you really work that way, however, you will see something important. You will recognize that in childhood we must be free of the coarsely material laws of the world. The earlier you apply such rules to the child, the more you bring the child to a state in which playing is no longer a free activity. Children need truths they can embrace with heart and soul, so they need not be slaves to what occurs in the outer world. This is why you should tell fairy tales and myths that go into the soul. In that way you can create inner truths that free the soul. Previously, humanity did that instinctively, but in our time it is necessary to be more conscious of the need to do it. Now someone might ask how a teacher could recognize a child's particular talents. That is really not so difficult. One of the basic characteristics of a teacher, as I mentioned in a more comprehensive manner, is modesty before what is struggling to free itself as the essence of an individual. If you are humble before something that has been developing for thousands of years, something that we must help develop further, we will feel a responsibility that brings life to our souls. It gives us a particular quality. It gives us a stroke of genius. Teachers often have no idea why they do the right things. Children say what they need. The most important thing that we need in the education profession is the love that results when we learn to love the personality just beginning to develop. We will see what this love can accomplish with the spirit. In outer life, love is often blind. However, when we connect love to inner development, then it acts to open the soul. Behind that love exists a still more powerful belief, which acts on us to create the capacity to consider life in the proper manner, and which reveals to us the human being placed into the world of spiritual and sense-perceptible life. As teachers, our task is to create the connection between those two. We see in the child how the spirit descends and weds human physicality. When we see that, when we see how the spirit weds human physicality in the child, our teaching will express what we can call a true belief in life, and this can be expressed as follows. Quote, "The richness of matter impinges upon the human senses from the mysterious depths of the cosmos. The clear light of the spirit floods into the depths of the soul from the heights of the cosmos. They unite within the human being to create wisdom-filled reality." End quote, that I think was from Steiner, and the end of this lecture.